Hemel devotees, all glories to this Hemel devotees, all glories to this Hemel devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Gauranga, glories to Srila Prabhupada. Mam Vishnubhraya, Krishna Vasaya, Vidlai, Srimad Bhaktivedanta Shani, Nandi. Namaste, Saraswati Devi, Guru Vani Bhacharani, Nam Shishnya, Bari Vashitari, Srani. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Did you read those two verses from?
Yeah, we're on the 17:18.
Okay. So we continue from yesterday, starting with section 17:8-2, the continuation of the Parishishtam or appendix after the Vinodakam, those special items for students who are working for Bhakti Vaibhava degree. So the rest of this Parishishtam is of general interest to everyone. And it consists of memorable quotations from Srila Prabhupada's purports to this chapter. So the first quotation comes from the purport to the first verse. And we've titled it, The First Symptom of Kali. So-called Kshatriyas, who are really Shudras and degraded Vaishyas, who cooperate to make animal slaughter a big business. Prabhupada writes, the principal sign of the age of Kali is that lower class Shudras, that is, men without Brahminical culture and spiritual initiation, will be dressed like administrators or kings, and the principal business of such non-Kshatriya rulers will be to kill the innocent animals, especially the cows and the bulls, who shall be unprotected by their masters, the bona fide Vaishyas, the mercantile community. In Bhagavad Gita 18:44, it is said that the Vaishyas are meant to deal in agriculture, cow protection, and trade. In the age of Kali, the degraded Vaishyas, the mercantile men, are engaged in supplying cows to slaughterhouses. The Kshatriyas are meant to protect the citizens of the state, whereas the Vaishyas are meant to protect the cows and bulls and utilize them to produce grains and milk. The cow is meant to deliver milk and the bull is meant to produce grains. But in the age of Kali, the Shudra class of men are in the posts of administrators, and the cows and bulls, or the mothers and the fathers, unprotected by the Vaishyas, are subjected to the slaughterhouses organized by the Shudra administrators. So, indeed, this is a prime symptom of the perversion of religious principles in this age. There was, he's dead now, this founder of the famous McDonald's chain of hamburger fast food establishments. And he made a statement to the effect that he took his business of serving massive supply of hamburgers across the United States, across the world, as seriously as other people take religion. He said, just as the Christians are believing in Jesus or Muhammad, or believe in, the Muslims believe in Muhammad, so I believe in hamburgers. So he made this very determined statement. He's very proud of himself for feeling this way. So what this indicates is that, yes, we all have, as human beings, an innate propensity to dedicate ourselves to some cause or other, to some ideal or other. So in Kali Yuga, it is very unfortunate that a man who is highly placed in society, that means he has money at his disposal, he can actually realize his plans, expand his program throughout the world. It's so unfortunate that such a man utilizes this facility given to him by God for the propagation of, as is indicated here, the first symptom of the age of Kali, is the slaughter of cows and bulls, transforming that which used to be a most reprehensible activity. In fact, I believe a little later in the same list of purports, the title to the short quotation from purport to verse 6 is called Death to the Animal Killers. This is actually the Shastric rule that applies to the Kshatriyas, the real Kshatriyas. It is their duty to take the lives of those who kill animals. But this age is so degraded. As Prabhupada points out, those in the position of Kshatriyas are not really Kshatriyas, they're Shudras. Which means that their artha, their sense of value in life, is simply sense gratification. That which gratifies the senses, that's good. So if someone can come along and make a grand arrangement for, according to their palates, tasty foodstuffs in the form of cow flesh prepared as hamburgers, they will go along with it. They will have no problem with it whatsoever. Give all state support to it. And the result is that in this way, extreme sinful activities become widespread throughout the world. And of course, following on the heels of such extremely degraded and excessive sense indulgence will come extreme sinful reactions. This was seen, for example, in the Second World War. Nowadays, the Second World War has, in people's minds, become some kind of icon of human depravity, which was fortunately stopped by the good people of the world. But this is all nonsense. Srila Prabhupada clearly said that in the history of the world, the recorded history of the world, there have actually only been two really valid battles that were fought. And one was the battle for Lanka that was fought by King Ram and Hanuman and Sugriva against Ravana, and the other was the Battle of Kurukshetra fought between the Pandavas and the Kauravas. I once mentioned this at a public lecture in one city in Europe, and there was great objection to this from the audience. There were several people who were protesting. No, but the Second World War, that was also Yuddha Dharma. There was even one Indian man who was taking part on this side. He was saying it was Yuddha Dharma. It was religious war because these Nazis, these National Socialists under Hitler, they were the very personification of evil. But actually all they were was simply the hand of sinful reaction. They talk so much about the butchering of so many innocent people. But if you examine how that was done, you see the same thing is going on today. Hundreds and thousands daily, hundreds and thousands of living entities, perhaps. No, even they are walking on two legs. Chickens, and they have two legs. But not just them. Goats and sheep and ultimately cows and bulls. They're being crammed into railroad cars, onto the trailers, on the back of buses. You can. This is quite evident if one visits any Western country and travels on the freeway, highway, autobahn. One will see these kind of vehicles. And they're filled with these innocent creatures, and they're bleating, and they're totally helpless. And they're being transported to their death. They will arrive at some slaughterhouse, and the doors of the vehicle will be opened, and they will be prodded off with cattle prods that give electric shock to get them moving. And they will quickly be examined by some medical officer to see that they're in good health. And those who are in good health then will be immediately sent to the line where they'll be slaughtered and cut up for human food. And those who are not such in good health, then they may be put in the line where they'll be made into glue or something like that. The bones will be cooked down into glue or some other so-called valuable substance. But same thing is going on today that went on during the Second World War, only with human beings who themselves are meat eaters. So this is the arrangement of the material energy. Srila Prabhupada, in one purport, explains that Goddess Kali, she's the goddess of destruction. It is her function to gather together en masse human beings who deserve to be cruelly slaughtered. Their time has come due, and now they should be killed at one stroke. So she gathers them together. In disastrous situations, perhaps they all board a plane that is to crash, or they're all gathered in a city that will be bombed from the air, and so many of them will be died or subject to very severe injuries, or there will be a plague, that pestilence that will spread rapidly through the population and kill them. But somehow or other she does this. She gathers them together, and at one stroke she kills them. And so this is the result of their sinful activity. So this was actually done just 50 years ago or so, during the Second World War time, where human beings were actually forced to undergo. Millions and millions of human beings were forced to experience the treatment of animals that is going on even today. The transportation and the slaughter of hundreds and thousands and millions of animals. And they're very proud of this. This McDonald's company, as I said, this founder of McDonald's, he said, "This is my religion," he said with great conviction. Just as others may believe in the Bible or the Quran or in Jesus Christ or Muhammad. So I believe, I firmly believe in the widespread distribution of hamburgers. So this is actually, he's an agent of material nature, an agent of Kali, an agent of spreading sin, which will have the severest reactions, of course, for him, because he's planning the whole thing, executing the whole thing, and for anyone who partakes in the result. It is stated in Shastra, for eating the flesh of even one cow, just say, as Prabhupada said, human beings, they have to eat vegetables anyway. When you're served food, so-called food today, there will be on the side potatoes and green peas or broccoli. But then in the center, one slice of meat. And Prabhupada said, for eating that slice of meat, one has to undergo so much karmic torment. If it is a slice of beef, then one will have to take birth, as many births as there are hairs on the body of that one cow or bull, the flesh of that one cow or bull, and in that form be slaughtered again and again and again, for as many hairs as were on the body of that one animal. But people are habituated to eat hamburgers morning, noon, and night in the West. Hamburger breakfast, hamburger lunch, hamburger dinner. It is very common. So every day, daily, they're eating from so many different slaughtered cows. So how much sinful reaction is in store for them? So this is the first symptom of Kali. So these Kshatriyas, these rulers who make allowance for such activities, pass laws, their interest in passing laws to permit the slaughter of cows and bulls so that they can collect nice taxes from such business, increase the coffers of the state. They are not Kshatriyas all, they're Shudras. Shudras, they do not know the purpose of life. The Vaishyas, Srila Prabhupada addresses the Vaishyas here as being bona fide, yet at the same time degraded. Bona fide means they do know how to take care of cattle, cows and bulls and other animals. They do know how to grow crops. This they do know how to do. But they're degraded. They have no more interest in protecting the cow and the bull. So they're degraded in hand with these Shudras who are dressed just like Kali, dressed up in the finery of leadership, of royalty. Hand in hand, they propagate this number one symptom of the age of Kali throughout the world today, making animal slaughter a big business. We will continue.
Second purport. The second symptom of Kali, the secular state. In other words, the state is committed to irreligion, while religious belief is a matter of personal opinion. The next symptom of the age of Kali is that principles of religion, which are all spotlessly white, like the white lotus flower, will be attacked by the uncultured Shudra population of the age. They may be descendants of Brahmana or Kshatriya forefathers, but in the age of Kali, for one of sufficient education and culture of Vedic wisdom, such a Shudra-like population will defy the principles of religion, and persons who are religiously endowed will be terrified by such men. They will declare themselves as adherents to no religious principles, and many isms and cults will spring up in Kali Yuga only to kill the spotless bull of religion. The state will be declared to be secular or without any particular principle of religion, and as a result, there will be total indifference to the principles of religion. The citizens will be free to act as they like, without respect for sadhu, shastra, and guru. It's interesting that the conditioned soul can't actually function without religion. They have to have something, some religion. So as previous purport, then Maharaj pointed out that, you know, this Mr., what do you call it, Ronald McDonald or whatever it is, his religion was burgers, you know, like that. So everyone will have a religion. So therefore all these isms, these are all so-called made-up religions. Right? You can't get by without one. If you're conditioned, you can't function without one. So there's no question anybody should be under illusion that they are secular. No, even the secular state, that's a religion. We don't adhere to any religion is a religion. Because they make great pains to see that they don't adhere. So something will have to be done, but the problem is that then it's always against the Vedic principles. It's always against the actual organized religion. Because if you want to say the state doesn't have a particular religion, fine. But that doesn't mean that the state doesn't protect religion. Right? The Kshatriyas themselves, they may practice their own personal, determination. But their populace may be something else, or a mix of that. So that doesn't mean that the state has no religion. Its principle is that the religion is it protects others in their rule. Does that make sense? In other words, if it's there, it's mentioned in Manu that the king, there may be rules in that are specifically local. It's a local custom. So as long as it's not against the Vedic concept, like that, then the king sees that it's upheld. So someone will be tried on a rule that they wouldn't be tried, let's say, if you're following the religion, you know, Manu, but because it's locally accustomed, so therefore it's upheld by the king. So that's their business, is to uphold religion. That's what the king is for. The Brahmins establish it, the Brahmins uphold it. But unfortunately, nowadays, then they defy them. You know, they take great pleasure in saying, we have no religion, but their religion is irreligion. They follow it very strictly, like that. So that's, yeah. Because it shouldn't be there's indifference, it should be this followed nicely. It means in the Vedic, technically speaking, if you look at Sanatana Dharma, or you look at the Varnashram, it's a religion. And each aspect of it is a religion. So you have eight separate but interrelated religions. And that's called Varnashram Dharma, because religion means the inherent nature of something. Right? So Brahmacharya has an inherent nature. So then the king should see that the Brahmacharyas are behaving as such. You can choose whatever you want. But once you've chosen, you follow that. You're a Brahmin, you follow that. Kshatriya, you follow that. Like this. Does that make sense? So in the same way, as even if you want to extend it to the modern, you know, you say you're Christian. Okay, what are the Christian rules? What makes you a Christian? What's Christian food? What's Christian drink? There should be a standard. You know? So whatever is the religion, you have a standard. You're following it. You know? You don't want to follow it, then follow something you will follow. You know, but you have to have some kind of cultural standard like that.
Another interesting point, while listening to Maharaj, came to mind, that the word religion comes from Latin, religio, and the meaning of this word is practically a synonym for yoga, because the root is lig. So we have, like in the body, ligaments, you know, like between this part of the arm and this part of the arm, there is this joint, elbow, and it's held together by a type of tissue called ligament, linking tissue, very strong. So, you know, I can move my hand like that and it doesn't, forearm doesn't go flying off and break off and hit the wall. So, religio means to link again with God. Just as yoga, the root is yuj. And I was just reading that in Vedic Sanskrit, the root word yuj is actually used for yoke. And, you know, to yoke bulls to a cart. Means of connecting. And so it is therefore clearly understandable that the word yoga and the English, the Sanskrit word yoga and the English word yoke, not only do they sound similar, but they mean something very similar, and they actually have the same origin, the same ultimate root. Vedic Sanskrit, when we say Vedic Sanskrit, we mean the Vedic language before Patanjali perfected it. Patanjali, he...
Probably an easier way to explain it would be the vocabulary used in the four Vedas.
Right, the four Vedas.
And then Patanjali gave the definition of the grammar used in the Smriti, mm-hmm. in the other classical Sanskrit literatures.
Yeah.
So it's kind of more... for poetics, it's more sweet and a little more slightly colloquial, while the Vedic is more rigid and esoteric, you could say.
So, yoga and yoke. So similarly, religion, when you... The idea is to connect with God, and there must be a medium by which you connect with him. So, Srila Prabhupada gave this very simple analogy of the sun. So to see the sun, to be connected with the sun, what must be there? The sunshine. The rays of the sun must reach your eyes. And the rays of the sun are the sun's energy. Then you can have relationship with the sun. You can see the sun disk in the sky. If the rays of the sun are unable to reach your eyes, there's no question of seeing the sun, even though the sun may be there. For instance, if it's a very heavily overcast day, one will not be able to see the sun because not enough light rays are reaching your eyes. So, religion necessarily entails the medium of relationship, which is the Lord's energy. So, in Kali Yuga, religions have sprung up which are so-called monotheistic. They talk of one God, but they disrespect the Lord's energy. They have actually very little place in their theology for religion, for the energy of the Lord, except as just a means for sense gratification. So in the history of Christianity, when Christianity began to spread, so the Christians, as they gained power, they very vehemently, with great zeal, stamped out all demigod worship, which was quite prevalent in Greece and Rome and other parts of Europe. They very vigorously stamped it out, and those who had continued to practice would be harassed, punished, burned at the stake. And the result of this You see, this idea, very, very sort of negative and pessimistic outlook, which became prominent during the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages were was the period before the so-called Renaissance, the blooming of European civilization. There was a period known as the Dark Ages. That was many people were locked away in monasteries. Everyone was expecting at any time Jesus Christ to come back. There was no hope of any future. The world was an unhappy place. Yes, as a matter of fact, actually, many people expected. You see, initially, the second coming of Christ was estimated to be 100 AD, 100 years after the birth of Christ. And the Christians readied themselves for that, and then that year came and went, and nothing happened. So then they added another zero, and he said it'll be 1000 AD. And that accounts for the Dark Ages, because the Dark Ages extended up to about the year 1000 AD. These Dark Ages are actually different from the Middle Ages. There's not much to say about it, except that people were just, they were just miserably going about their their work in the fields and maintaining their bodies and praying and worried about the devil and worried about witches and like that. You see a very bleak existence with no future. And mainly, when will Jesus come back to get us out of this? So when the year 1000 rolled around, then it is said all over Europe, people, they just abandoned their livestock and their farms. They just left their farms. They flocked to Rome, which was the holy center of the Catholic Church. And there was a Pope, Sylvester II. And he did the midnight mass. He himself personally performed the midnight mass on December 31st, 999. And it's described, historians describe, that people were dying of heart attacks during that mass, because they were just expecting, now the heavens will open and Christ will come out and we're all going to be judged and the world will be finished, and those who are going to go to heaven will be taken up to heaven, and those who are going to go to hell will go to hell forever. Now the time has come among us. In other words, these people saw no real purpose for the energy of the Lord. So their outlook was very bleak and pessimistic. But of course, yes, the year 1000 rolled around, nothing happened. And so there was a big crisis of faith. And so then later popes, the popes coming a few years later, they were actually obliged, because the Christians were becoming quite disappointed by all this and were demanding to know, why didn't Jesus come? So then this is what started off the Crusades. The first of the Crusades was begun in the year 1092, because Pope Urban, he declared that the reason Christ didn't come, you see, he will come in his own city, which is Jerusalem. But those infidel Muslims have taken over Jerusalem. So it's our duty as Christians to go there and kick them out. And when the city of Jerusalem is cleansed of both Muslims and, of course, Jews, who were the ones who killed Christ in the first place, when their blood is flowing freely in the streets, then Jesus will be happy to come and bless us, the faithful. So that all these crazy Christians started marching to Jerusalem and murdering people on the way. The Jews and the Muslims that they met on the way, and there were great battles. And they conquered Jerusalem, and they conquered it again and again and again and again. And still Jesus didn't come back. And so what followed this era of the... Actually, what immediately followed this era of the Crusades was the Black Plague, because the Christian soldiers picked it up in Jerusalem. This it's called the pest, this virulent disease which spread across Europe and killed off 2/3 of the population. That was the big result of their effort to force Christ to come back by conquering Jerusalem 5 times in a row. Is that 2/3 of the European population was wiped out by the plague. So this started Christians to think. And what they started to think about is that here we are in this world, and they've been telling us that this world is useless, worthless. It's the, you know, there was these three things that Christians were taught to be beware of. The world, the flesh, and the devil. These were like the three arch enemies of faith in Christ, in God. The world, the flesh, and the devil. So Christians started gradually to have second thoughts about this. We've been warned about this again and again, but nothing's happening. Jesus isn't coming back. We follow these church leaders. They tell us to go on crusades and we just get killed and diseases spread throughout our homeland and kill us off. So maybe they're wrong. So then after this period of the pestilence, the plague, there came what is known as the Renaissance. The Renaissance was a time when people started to rethink values and they started to look at the world differently. And that was a period of artists painting beautiful pictures of nature, beautiful pictures of young girls. They started to rediscover Maya, in other words.
It was interesting, you just mentioned about that early pictures of Maya. I was in Italy, I saw this, it was a book and it had all these classic paintings, so we know some of them. But in there was one where it had a very small girl, a little bit bigger girl, just an adolescent girl, then a little bit bigger married girl, then a mother, and then a, you know, middle-aged woman, then a grandmother, then an old lady, and then a dead lady, all in the same picture.
Yeah.
You know, so
passage of time.
Yeah, it was interesting there.
So anyway, European civilization gradually became geared again to sense gratification. And this is analyzed by historians, that it all started with the Christians themselves when they took over with their very negative attitude towards nature. Because previously, the so-called pagans had been worshipping nature gods, like Zeus, the god of thunder, or different goddesses of nature awarding the bounties of crops and so on and so forth. If one wanted good crops, then one should worship this goddess. If one wanted a nice child, one should worship this one. That one, the other one. Christianity stopped all that and said, don't have any material expectation whatsoever, because Christ is coming very soon and all this will finish, all this will perish, and you have to be counted among the faithful and go with Christ back to heaven. So historians point out that it was this very teaching that ultimately resulted in what we see today, the widespread madness for sense gratification. Because this was not real religion. This was some kind of upadharma that was
based on a misguided principle of tyaga, renunciation, without any sense of how to use the energy of the Lord in the service of the Lord. So this we should also understand when we read such statements as this: such a sudra-like population will defy the principles of religion. And persons who are religiously endowed will be terrified by such men. Yes, in those days, someone who would dare to be a little, there's one famous Italian philosopher. What was his name? Bruno something. So he dared to be more open to cosmology, to nature, to a place of nature and the plan of God. And so there's a piazza in Rome called the Piazza of Bruno, what's his name? Giordano, yeah, Bruno Giordano. That's where he was burned at the stake for being too soft, you see. So Krishna consciousness, in Krishna consciousness, it's not simply worship of a monotheistic God. Of course, that is there, but there is a worship and understanding of his energy, understanding that we cannot approach him except through his energy. And therefore, in the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, what is the first word that is addressed? Hare, the energy of the Lord. Because there's no question of approaching the Lord except through his energy. And the whole test of devotional service is in knowing how to use the energy of the Lord properly in his service. You see? This is the principle of yukta vairagya. Neither indulging one's senses in sense gratification, but on the other side, neither artificially restraining one's senses from engaging in their natural objects. But there's a means, there's a middle path by which one engages one's senses in their objects in the service of the Lord. And that is the foundational basis of true Vedic civilization. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada said, he always used to say, a Brahman is liberal-minded. Brahman is liberal-minded because he sees that there are all sorts of different natures, human beings with different natures, but somehow or other they can be engaged in the service of the Lord according to their nature. One should not come with a sledgehammer and try to beat their nature out of them. No, you can't do this. This is wrong. You must be like this. You must... You know, there was a period in the Dark Ages where practically every other young man was becoming a monk. You can still see in places in Western Europe like Austria and South Germany. There are so many, many monasteries, great, 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 colossal buildings with many, many rooms. Now they're inhabited, the whole place will be inhabited by half a dozen monks. And so many rooms and corridors are just closed down. But they used to be overflowing with monks. But these monks, people used to laugh at them because they were the crazies of society. They didn't know what else to do, so they just become monks. And they'd be locked up in their monastery, saying their prayers, and then on fast days, getting so hungry, they didn't know what to do. So one of them, he discovered that, the literal rule is that one should not eat during fast, but I found out that if you take grains and soak them in water and let them sit overnight, then it becomes this very nectarian beverage that when you drink, you feel very good, you feel very lightheaded, you feel
This was how beer was discovered. And the best beer in the world is manufactured in cities like Munich. München is the German way of saying Munich, and it means the city of monks. So München is, they have their Oktoberfest, this period where everyone goes out to drink beer for 1 month straight. So this is what the monks were up to in those days, inventing beer. And in France, they invented champagne. The same monks, they invented champagne. The monk who invented champagne, after he drank the first glass of it and his head started to spin, he said, "Truly I have discovered the nectar of the angels." And he fell on his face. And all the other monks rushed to also have a drink of it. So you see, religion is much more than just some fanatical adherence to belief in one God. That's not enough. One has to know what is the place of the energy of the Lord, how to use it, how to practically engage it in the service of the Lord so that one's nature will be purified. And that is exactly what Bhagavad Gita is all about. Arjuna's whole problem in the beginning is that he did not know how to engage his nature in the service of the Lord. He had to fight a battle which he thought was sinful. And so he wanted to give it up. He actually wanted to become a monk. He actually wanted to become a begging sannyasi, a bhikshu. And Krishna told him, "Don't be foolish. Just follow my instructions." So this is real religion. And because of this false religion, then the result is, as Prabhupada says here, the state will be declared to be secular or without any particular principle of religion. Because why should it have any particular principle of religion when all the religions have been like that? You see? And the citizens will be free to act as they like without respect for sadhu, shastra, and guru. Religion has become a joke.
Purport 3, milk and Sanatan Dharma. For a Sanatanist is a follower of Vedic principles. It is the duty of every householder to have cows and bulls as household paraphernalia, not only for drinking milk, but also for deriving religious principles. The Sanatanists worship cows on religious principles and respects Brahmanas. The cow's milk is required for the sacrificial fire, and by performing sacrifices, the householder can be happy. The cow's calf not only is beautiful to look at, but also gives satisfaction to the cow, and so she delivers as much milk as possible. But in the Kali Yuga, the calves are separated from the cows as early as possible for purposes which may not be mentioned in these pages of Srimad Bhagavatam.
Yeah, so we see the cows and the Brahmins are important. It's always mentioned the cows, then the Brahmins. It's because the Brahminical culture is founded on this, on the cows. When there's milk, then you have ghee performing sacrifice, and then with milk, then that develops the finer brain tissues by which you can understand the Vedic literatures. Then you can have Brahminical culture. So that's why the cow is given the prominence, because of that. Not that the cow itself is specifically more important than the Brahmin, but the cow itself provides the facility for Brahminical culture. We see also here's the relationship aspect of even the cow and the calf. Because the calf is there, then the cow is very happy. And so the one is seeing that is going on. Because then the householder wants to be happy. So then by performing these activities, they can become happy. There's not another way. We see is that, you know, as Maharaj is describing the scenario over the last few thousand years of religious satisfaction has basically not ended up in much satisfaction. You got the opposite result. And even the opposite result, they're not satisfied either, because you can't please the senses and you can't function without the senses. So then what to do? So that's then the Vedic literatures give, as Maharaj pointed out, that the senses are engaged in the service of the Lord. Like that. You can't ignore them, and the only way you can be, if you engage it in the Lord's service, Lord being satisfied will be satisfied. But the senses themselves you cannot satisfy on their own. It doesn't work. It's like how much water, can you, pour over a cliff. Right? You can go on pouring water over the cliff unlimitedly. Like that. And so there's no satisfaction. So it's only when the sense is engaged in the Lord's service, then it's engaged, which you can't avoid, and your satisfaction because the Lord's satisfied.
And on this point again, Brahmins, cows, and then the previous quotation concerning Shudra religion, Shudra-like population and their defiance of religion, religious principles. I recall one story when Srila Prabhupada was with some disciples, and the maha plate had been brought, so he was distributing milk sweets to his disciples. And one disciple there, a sannyasi, he refused. He said, "No, Srila Prabhupada, I don't take sweets." And Prabhupada said, "You are simply Shudra." So there actually, you see, there actually is a way to engage the senses nicely, even gratifying them, which is in the mode of goodness and which is pleasing to Krishna.
It's interesting because just on the Pandavas in the previous chapter, Yudhishthira is making the comment how by Krishna's grace, then we have this position and facilities and good wives, good children, good social standing and wealth and everything. So it's not that those things are a problem. It's having those things that are not connected to the Lord. The difficulty with it, because, how you say, like in the Hindu culture, there's not a much of a difficulty in engaging the senses. In proper ways according to Shastra. They'll cook, they'll do all these different things. It's normal for them. What they sometimes forget is about the Lord, or the connection. They'll worship the Lord and they'll engage the senses. And sometimes they match them, sometimes they don't. But now, it was always interesting, so I always took it back to the Protestants. I see it goes even farther back. Is that in the description that Maharaj gave, we can see that the concept that the senses are engaged in the sense objects according to the Lord's direction and therefore in the Lord's service does not exist in Christianity, modern Christianity. It just doesn't exist. Therefore, I was always wondering where this concept came from, that we have our sadhana and those things connected to the worship and sadhana, and that's devotional, and everything else is something else, is our life. And that's where you have to be afraid of the world, afraid of the flesh, afraid of the devil. I was always wondering why there would be such a very clear division, and it's like universal. It's not like some have this aspect or that. It's like very clear. It's like, you wear your devotional clothes, you go to the temple, you take your bath, you eat your prasad, you chant your japa, you put up some pictures of Krishna, you put on some music of Krishna, and that's it. That's where spiritual life ends. Everything else after that, that's our own life. And then, because of the Kali Yuga, then our own life is not connected to Varnashram. We make up our own because it's secular. So I was always wondering where this came from. But now by your historical exposition there, then it... So this is the point, is that the Vedic culture does not deny the senses, but it denies the point of engaging them if not engaged in the Lord's service. Because if not engaged in the Lord's service, it's animals. Animals are engaging the senses. No one complains about it. But they're animals. But when they're connected to the Lord, that's human. Then you're satisfied. Then you get out of here. Because you're not going to go from here if there's always, well, I didn't get this, I didn't get that, I want this, I want that. So then the idea comes up also in the modern thing, you know, because in the small circle it goes back and forth between restriction and, you know, hedonism, restriction and hedonism. So then that there's been restriction, and from restriction people aren't satisfied. But so therefore we will be unrestricted, then we'll be satisfied. But you can't be. So it's only when the senses are not ignored, like those who are too strict, but are engaged in the Lord's service, which is missing in those who agree to utilization of the senses, then there's satisfaction. And if you're satisfied, then you can see there's nothing here. So this idea is, oh, I spent so many years, you know, restricting myself, and now, you know, I'm unhappy, so now let it go, and I'll be happy. No, it'll be just as much frustration. It's a matter of, unless it's properly acknowledged and engaged in the Lord's service, it's not going to work. So that's Sanatana Dharma, is that everything's eternal, including your senses. So you might as well get used to it and start engaging them in the service of the eternal. It's like the perfect balance. It's like everything else, it's either you're going this side or that side, or this at the exclusion of the other. But when you can accept both there and find their balance, then it works.
The Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas are called twice born because for these higher classes of men there is one birth by parental conjugation, and there is another birth by cultural renovation, rejuvenation by spiritual initiation from the bona fide acharya, or spiritual master. So a Kshatriya is also twice born like a Brahmana, and it is his duty to give protection to the helpless. The Kshatriya king is considered to be the representative of God to give protection to the helpless and chastise the miscreants. Whenever there are anomalies in the routine work by the administrators, there is an incarnation of the Lord to reestablish the principles of a godly kingdom. Yeah, so that's the Vedic principle of dvija, means that the first birth is animal birth. That's all. Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. That's what a kid does. So they have to be trained to be human, which is to take up the Vedic principles and understanding God consciousness. So that's why dvija is important. That's the difference. Shudra means they don't bother. They remain animal their whole life. But, you know, they assisting the others, they get the benefits. But dvija means that we take up the spiritual consciousness and rejuvenate. It's interesting, the words here. They're used at conjugation. So perfectly using the English. You know. And rejuvenation means reviving from just, you know, material life, reviving back to the spiritual, because that's the nature of the soul. Like that. I also thought it was very nice that purport of Prabhupada is pointing out the kings, Kshatriyas protect the citizens of the state and everybody in general, and the Vaishyas, they protect the animals. I thought that was really interesting. So, because they're very similar, Vaishyas and Kshatriyas. But at the same time, as one is protecting the state for religious principles and one is protecting the animals for economic development. Like that, but similar, very similar. Yeah. So whenever there's anomalies, then Krishna comes. Like that. So now he's come as his Sankirtan mission, he's come as his holy name to reestablish the principles of a godly kingdom.
How about the next one?
To conclude, okay. Death to the animal killers. For a pious king, the culprit who kills an animal in a secluded place is punishable by the death penalty, exactly like a murderer who kills an innocent child in a secluded place. Because the animal can only be killed through sacrifice. If it's not, it's sin. It can't be allowed. Like that. So in this age, animal sacrifices are forbidden. Therefore, there's no, you know, how you say, approved killing of animals. But
Yeah, so it's the same principle, because if it's done without sacrifice, then it is sin. And Prabhupada's pointing out that the animals are innocent. They don't know. They're just doing their animal business. So they don't know what's going on here with all this human business. So then it's the same, like, just as the children are protected, then the animals are protected. You know, they're also considered citizens of the state. Maybe non-voting, but citizens nonetheless.
So did they hand in an essay?
Yeah, yes.
Okay. All right then, so we'll see you on Thursday.
Yes. Same place, same
Thursday
time.
At 8 o'clock.
Yes. Same
Thank
stage.
Thank you very much.
Jai. Jai.